Adult Authors. I'm Joanne Morrell, children's and young adult fiction writer and author of Short Nonfiction for Authors. Thanks for joining me for the Hybrid Author Podcast, sharing interviews from industry professionals to help you forge a career as a hybrid author, both independently and traditionally publishing your books. You can get the show notes for each episode and sign up for your free author pass over at the Hybrid Author website to discover your writing process, get tips on how to publish productively, and get comfortable promoting your books at www.hybridauthor.com.au. Let's crack on with the episode.
Authors, I hope you're all keeping well in whatever part of the world you reside and listen to the podcast in. Today's interview is with author and screenwriter Liz Zigg, and we are chatting about setting up as a micro publisher through print on demand, POD. So in my author adventure this week, it's been a busy week of lots of meetings. I had a meeting with a VA, still trying to sort of outsource some work, which is not really going to plan. But yeah, so I'm going to figure out whether I'll just end up doing the work or, you know, by the time I actually find somebody or get round to finding somebody, might be quicker just to do it myself. I have also been quite productive, not so much with word count or anything like that, but with this women's fiction project that I am moving forward with doing the Kickstarter for. So if you've not been listening to the podcast, I am going to be doing a Kickstarter. There'll be more details to follow shortly on that, so keep your eye ready for that. The work is already written and it has been professionally edited. It's been now professionally proofread. I'm moving forward with the cover, a local artist, and he sent me a mock-up of it today and it's absolutely amazing. So that's going ahead. With the Kickstarter, you offer tiers as incentives for backers, and you can give away swag with the book, like different things. And I've got a big idea for this. So I've been visiting wholesalers and other people that is involved in the process to see if my big idea can come to life. So there'll be more on that as well. Very excited about this, and so that's really taken a lot of my time in between. My personal life's been flying off the handle this week, and that's really required my attention, as children do, and so that's where my main focus has been this week. But in between all that, I have filled it with book business stuff where I can, and I have written some of the YA fiction book that I'm writing, but for the most part I've had to put that down to focus on this women's fiction project. And with Rottnest Writers Retreat looming in June, you know, I wanted to have the full manuscript finished by then, but we will see. If not, that's what Rottnest Writers Retreat's there for. My critique stuff's in, all the other stuff is kind of done, so I can pretty much work on that book while I'm there. It's really important to probably get most of this Kickstarter stuff aligned before I go. It's all about finding hierarchy of work, projects, and obviously executing them. So if you love the podcast or any of the episodes has helped you further in your author career, you can now pay it forward by buying me a coffee over at buymeacoffee.com/thehybridauthor. Let's all support each other. Liz Zigg has worked in publishing for the last 15 years, specializing in structural editing and self-publishing. He is the author of This, published by Midnight Sun, Prudence, ECG Press, August Falling, Pantera Press, and Just Another Week in Suburbia, also Pantera Press, and Pride, Busy Bird Publishing. His stories focus on characters facing adversity, trying to find their place in the world. He's had 4 screenplays optioned and unproduced screenplays place and shortlist in over 100 competitions. His stories and articles have been published in various print and digital journals, and he also runs workshops on writing, editing, and publishing. Welcome to the Hybrid Author Podcast, Liz.
Thanks for having me on, Jo.
Oh, we're thrilled to have you. So we'll just get started. How did you come to have this amazing career in writing and publishing?
I've loved writing since I was a kid. The story I always tell is I read Lord of the Rings when I was 11, 12, And wasn't just the story, it was the depth of the world building just overawed me. You know, everywhere they went, geography had history, all these characters had this amazing lineage. So I was just so overwhelmed that one person could do this. And I really wanted to get into writing myself. So when I was 15, I handwrote my first fantasy novel, which I'm sure would be awful. But ever since, you know, everything I've done has been, you know, geared towards telling stories.
That's right. And you've obviously got a lot of books out there and screenplays. You've got that storytelling aspect, I guess, so the format doesn't seem to hold you back.
I find like for myself, sitting down to write is the one time I really feel meditative and, you know, feel like I'm doing what I'm meant to do. Sorry, it makes me sound terrible, but I don't really get that anywhere else in life. You sort of get a purpose out of creating these worlds and telling these stories. So issues that come with that, but you know, the actual act of telling a story, it's something I've just always loved.
No, it's nice to hear because, you know, a lot of people talk about the hardships of writing and things like that. And sometimes the conversations are, we often forget the joy. So why are
Yeah.
you doing it? Well, because, yeah, we love it as well.
I mean, it can be frustrating trying to get somewhere, you know, there's dead ends and things aren't working. But when you start to see it coming together and all that, it's just so gratifying.
Yeah. Well, what came first for you, the novels or the screenplays?
No, the novels. So in year nine English, I wrote epic short stories, and I'm sure the teachers didn't read. So I don't blame them. Yeah. So, and like I said, I handwrote my first novel when I was 15, 16. And then I did that on a typewriter and I did it on a computer. And I grew up in the 1980s. So this is before home computers were, you know, a household necessity. So back then, no one had a home computer with a word processor. They were all sort of gaming computers. Yeah. I started by hand, then I went to typewriter, and then PCs just started to come in, and I jumped to a PC.
Amazing. And have you ventured over to dictating yet?
No, I don't. I find like for myself, a connection between, you know, sitting there and fingers on the keys. I don't know if I could actually have the discipline to dictate a story. There's a lot of false starts in mind. There's a lot of sort of going in one direction, realizing that's not the direction to go, and then coming back and deleting and then revising. And so I don't think I'd have that freedom if I was dictating.
Well, you said you're a podcaster. I think you'd be surprised how much you could probably talk out.
Yeah, I might try it one day, but yeah, for now I'm just happy to sit there and pipe. But yeah, I think I talk enough during the day, so.
Yeah, no, fair enough. And your screenplays, I'm very interested to know. You're obviously part of different industries. How did that all come about?
Screenwriting was just because I was studying drama and acting in my early 20s, and the director there, and I asked him if he'd be interested in seeing a screenplay, and he said if I put it in his hand, he'd read it. At that
Nice.
stage, I'd never ever written a screenplay, and this is back in about 90, 91, so no internet or pre, you know, internet's popularity and all that. So I actually had to go to the library and find a book about screenwriting, which I didn't do. I couldn't find one. I found one on playwriting, and I just bastardized that format and just started writing. And he didn't like the actual story, but he liked my writing, and he asked me to write a feature screenplay for him. He commissioned me to do it. Didn't go anywhere, which is more my fault, because back when I was 20, 21, I had all the answers. So
Didn't we all? Didn't we all?
So I took the story in direction probably that went a little bit, well, not went a lot away from his vision. But ever since that, I've kept a foot in that industry, trying to get something up and going in that one. But I mean, like any of the creative industries, it's just really hard, particularly in Australia, which is such a small industry and so impoverished in terms of the arts. But it's just something I still do on the side.
Amazing. Yeah, no, it's definitely an interest of mine and something that I am hoping to dip my feet into a bit more. I actually went to an event, I think it was about a week ago, and I didn't even know this place existed in Perth, and it was a studio space, which was like the first of, well, I don't know, the first of its kind, but in Perth anyway. And it's like a little cinema, but it's like a presenting room, and they did a presentation sort of on book to film, and it was like the adaptation and a chat, and this place was fantastic. And I thought, this is, I met a guy who'd worked on writing for Neighbours for 20 years, and I just thought, oh, this is where I need to be, around people who have sort of done this industry thing. So
It's interesting because the different formats have different narrative requirements. I mean, film, television, it's a visual art form. So, you know, in a book, I can have a character sitting in a chair just thinking for 4 pages. In a film, that would really be boring. So you have to think about the way story is communicating to suit each medium.
Yeah, that's it. I did a little bit at uni with the screenplays and stuff like that, but yeah, with the sort of screenwriting and things. But yeah, it's interesting to see what is included from the book to the film and why they sort of chose that or they didn't. important. And yeah, no, I find it really interesting. But today's topic is on setting up as a micro publisher through POD, print on demand. So first up, we'll just get you to define what this actually means. You know, some listeners might not understand what a micro publisher is or print on demand.
Okay, so we'll start with print on demand. I mean, years ago, if you wanted to print a book, you'd go to an offset printer. You'd need to print a bulk amount, at least 100, to make it worth your while, because the more you printed, the more each unit cost came down. So if you printed 100, it might be $10 per book. If you printed 500, it might be $9.50 per book, and so on. You know, you couldn't just do 20. If you're doing 20, you're probably going to get charged like $80 per book or something to print it. Print on demand's been there for a while, but it's really come into vogue since about 2016, 2017. There are the two main platforms, which are Ingram Spark and also Amazon's Kindle Direct Publishing. They're both American companies, but they both have facilities all around the world. And the way it works is, you know, you upload your print file. So there's a cover and an internals. And through these platforms, you can actually set it up to distribute to online retailers like Amazon, Booktopia, Barnes & Noble, those sort of places. So it'll appear in their catalogs. It just as a digital listing, but it'll appear in their catalogs. And, you know, if you see a book on Amazon that you like, you order it. The order is then relayed back to the print on demand facility. They print out that single copy for the person and it's shipped off to the purchaser. Now, if you want to buy books for yourself, you just go into your account and you order them as required. So you can order them, you know, you can order one, you can order 10, you can order 100. I mean, as the name suggests, you print them as the demand requires them. So it just means that you don't have to go for really big print runs. You know, first up, you don't end up with boxes of books, you know, in your home, which I know a lot of authors in the past have done. And it gives you global representation through all these online retail platforms. And these platforms too, when you set up to distribute through them, you actually set up the pricing for your book. So you're not paying anything in this regard. Like if someone buys a book, they're paying whatever price you've set and then whatever price the retailer's finalized. I mean, it's usually around what you set. And then all the costing's taken out of that. It's, you know, the cost of the sale for the platform, they'll take something, you know, as a commission. And then the cost of the print and demand facility to actually print it, produce it, and ship it out. They'll all take that out of the pricing. So you're not actually paying anything. And whatever's left over goes to you.
Amazing. It's definitely been a game changer for the publishing industry. And I myself use it. And it's fantastic. I feel for anybody listening, hearing all that for the first time, probably feels a bit daunting with it. But if they've got aspirations to be a micro publisher, you know, what are some of the skill sets that they would have to, authors might have to have to go about executing everything you just said there, you know, effectively?
Okay, I'll say theoretically, you could do all this for nothing. Now, I wouldn't recommend that, because when I'm saying theoretically you could do it for nothing, that's if you did your own editing and all that sort of stuff. Totally advocate you should get your book edited and get an editor to do it. Don't get, you know, we get a lot of part-time editors in the industry. We get, you know, people coming going, look, I don't need it edited. My neighbor edited it and he's a year 10 English teacher. You know, we get a lot of these sort of people who might have, you know, background in English, but they're not actual editors. So they don't really sort of know how books should be edited, but totally get it professionally edited. You know, cover design, if you're good at graphic art and all that sort of stuff, then you can do it. But you know, you'd be needing someone to do that. There'd be administration like the ISBN, which is the International Standard Book Number, which is like, it's a book's version of a license plate for a car. It's a unique identifier, so the book can be identified anywhere around the world. So you would be looking at people to help you produce the book from the ground up, from the editing to the design, and then to putting it all together and then putting it onto one of these print-on-demand platforms. It's not overly difficult, but there's a lot of information that comes at you, so that can be a little bit daunting to navigate. You know, years ago, everyone sort of, yeah, self-publishing was looked at as a vanity thing. That's why they called it, you know, vanity publishing. But it's really become a legitimate media now, because years ago, self-published books looked like they were knocked up together in someone's garage. You know, the paper was this really stiff white stuff and the covers were this thick cardboard. So it really looked like an amateur project. But nowadays you have access to the same technology big publishers are using. So you can produce a book that's physically indistinguishable from anything coming out of a big publisher. It's just up to you to make sure that the content is also of the same level, the same quality. I mean, sometimes I've seen authors who are like, no, it doesn't need editing. My ideas are so awesome that people want characters a few spelling mistakes or stuff like that, which is a fallacy because I mean I don't know what you're like as a reader, but if I'm reading something and I spot an error, it sort of takes me a little bit out of the story. And then if I spot a second error, I'm then just looking for problems in the book. So it punctures that suspension of disbelief or that immersion in the content. So you make sure that the content of your book is as good as it possibly can be. You get sort of one chance to make your first impression. A lot of people want to rush because it's such an exciting prospect to get your book out there globally, but it's really important that you make it as good as it possibly can be.
Yeah, you're absolutely speaking the truth there. And I learned from experience in my first year of uni, self-published a children's, you could argue, was it middle grade, was it junior fiction project? But I mean, it was a good starting point. I didn't really know much myself, but the thing that held me back was that I didn't get it professionally edited, and that just gave me crippling self-doubt. I couldn't get behind the work or anything like that. So I've kind of used that book, and regular listeners will be like, oh yeah, we know she talks about that all the time. But I do use that book. I hold it up and say, this is my lessons learned. It's always get your work professionally edited. I think from like an authorship perspective, obviously that's one part of it, getting your work to the highest standard professionally edited. In terms of making the product, although you can outsource all these people, and I guess like in a publishing house, thinking from a publishing perspective, if you're going to set up as a micro publisher for yourself and your work, you can pay the different people, obviously, if you're not an artist, a cover designer, which is really important, and then you're sending it on to like Ingram Spark or the print on demand places, so the quality comes from them. How much do you think you need to know about actual printing itself in terms of the technology behind it, sort of thing? Like, so I've got a couple of non-fiction books, and I have printed through Ingram Spark for those. Now, that was a learning curve for the first one in terms of sizing, because this book was very small. It was about, I call them short non-fiction, because the first one's only about 7,000 words. It's tiny. And it's like it's almost what I call, it's like a quick tips book. There's like 60 plus quick tips on freelance writing, business setup. And you just kind of, it's like little paragraphs, little quick tips, and you just can flick ahead. But originally, because the content was so small, and I think I had chosen a size that was fairly big, I honestly have, and again, I use all this as lessons learned in workshopping and stuff, about seven of these books in different sizes, because this was me just getting a feel for the content fitting in what size. So I guess thinking of the overall packaging of the product. And also, I had images in this book that just were coming faded all the time, and I found out it was to do with, I don't know if it was the ink on the paper or the type of paper. So I'm wondering, like, how much do you think you need to educate yourself on actual printing logistics as
That's a really
being as a
good,
micro publisher?
yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I one of the great things about both platforms is, with authors that we deal with, we always order a proof copy of a book so they can see what it looks like physically. And then, sometimes we get authors changing the paper type or whether the cover's gloss or matte or so. I don't think you really sort of need to know a lot about the actual specifications behind printing because, I mean, that's a specialty in itself. But something that would be important is to sort of go in and have a really good idea of what you want to do. So, I mean, just checking your own bookshelves or going to the library or going to a bookstore and then looking at the sort of books in that genre that you're writing and just looking at the format, looking at the sizes they use, things like that, jotting that down and then going to either of these platforms and then just sort of seeing what comparable sizes they have, what, paper stocks they have. I mean, the good thing about the proofing part of it is you can get it sent out to you like with gloss cover and white paper, and then you can change it over to matte paper, so to matte cover and cream paper and see what it looks like differently. So you can sort of play around with it. I mean, obviously it's going to cost you a little bit, but it's worth it to see what it's like in the, physically, because the way you envision it and the way it arrives are two different things. So I mean, I've been looking at like I just was sort of doing research about seeing what you like and then just trying to duplicate that, if that makes sense.
No, it absolutely does. And it's something that I do as well. There's a women's fiction project. I've got a self-published project. So I've gone to the bookstores and had a look at the shelves and seen like the sizes, I guess, in that genre that kind of catch my eye, like the bigger ones and how fat they are and all the rest of it. But yeah, I can't seem to find like the actual, where do they put it? I thought they would have put it in the inner page, like the actual sizing of the book. Do you have to find it online? I
The
couldn't
actual like
find
the width by
the,
length or
yeah, the like the dimensions of it, like it doesn't actually sort of state it.
I would just sneakily do it with a ruler or tape measure if it's paint.
Right,
I mean, if you go to
yeah.
a library, you can do it sort of a bit more casual. I mean, the other thing, just harking back to something else you said, if you're doing a series, think about the way the whole series is going to look, not just that first book.
That's a good tip.
If you look at, I mean, we have people who are doing fantasy series and that sort of thing. So think about stylistically what motifs you want to carry over the series, the type of covers, what it's going to look like, the actual word length is going to be sort of consistent throughout, because with series, you do want a little bit of that consistency to carry through because it gives you a sense of purpose and that it's really being thought out rather than sort of doing like something that's a really tiny size and then doing something huge because it's 80,000 words suddenly and all that sort of stuff. So think about how that actually looks throughout your whole series and a really good exercise just to envision if they're all sitting on the shelf, how would you like them to look? But stuff like colors of covers and that sort of stuff would do, they're going to be different bright colors. I mean, look at, they're not self-published, but you look at like the Harry Potter's were released a little while ago where each book had a unique bright color, which was sort of a really nice marketing thing. So think about the way you want that series to look with each book individually, but also the series as a whole.
Yeah, no, that's really good advice, actually. And also, there's some authors that I sort of follow in the UK and stuff and who self-publish, and they're all doing quite funky things. Have you heard of Kickstarter? Like, yeah. So most of them are doing these projects through Kickstarter. And so that's allowing them to make these really beautiful products with like embossing, and they're talking about sprayed edges. And I had to look it up because I was like, I've never heard of a sprayed edge. I did do a printing thing in my uni, and I find it really interesting. That's why, yeah, I'm quite asking the questions about how much you need to know about this sort of stuff. They're really, really experimenting, and I think it's really cool.
We've gotten a little bit of that in terms of, like, I'll take embossing, for example. So embossing, for people who don't know, is where the cover will have sort of raised, the text might be a little bit raised, where you can actually feel the grooves and that sort of stuff of it. And the print-on-demand facilities don't do that yet. Now, the thing is, they're constantly evolving. So, like, originally they weren't printing on the inside of covers either, but they're doing that now. So it's going to be constantly a process that evolves and incorporates things, to make the book a little bit fancier and all that sort of stuff.
So would that be more of like a local specialist printer? You would be sourcing for that, right?
Stuff like embossing. I mean, they still aren't using recycled paper, which is a little bit of a surprise, but I mean, recycled paper actually is generally more expensive than just standard paper. So there's sort of little things like that. The sprayed edges, as you said, they're not doing that. But I mean, previously I got Ingram Spark. They were doing, for hardcovers, they were doing dust jackets and case laminate. So case laminate's just the where they stick the cover image to the cover and it's got like that nice hard finish. Whereas a dust jacket you can peel off. But I actually noticed last time I looked that they actually we're doing a hardcover now, which had both. So it had the case laminate finish, but also the dust jacket. And the one thing I know with Ingram Spark is they're constantly adding so many sizes. So there's so many different ones to choose from. I mean, you're in an industry where you can really, if you wanted to be totally avant-garde, go do something totally your own way and just try and break out of, expectation. I mean, one thing with standard publishers are they are going to do things the standard way for the most part. As a self-published author and an indie author, as we call it, you can do whatever you like. You're the master of your own destiny. So going into self-publishing, you should really look at like, what do I want this to look like? And I know what else is happening in my genre and all that sort of stuff, but is there a different way I want to do it? Is there a way I'm going to stand out? Unfortunately, one of the things like I've heard most when I've been working in this industry is authors coming in and telling me, I've written a book or I've got an idea for a book and it's going to be a bestseller. And I mean, me and my boss, we used to just sort of roll our eyes, and it was like, it may be a bestseller, but it's not that easy. If it was, everyone would be doing it. And I think it's a sort of rite of passage for a lot of writers, because I used to think like that when I was, a lot younger, like last week. No, I used to think like that when I was like, in my teens and early 20s, and think, I'm going to break out, I'm going to be huge and all that sort of stuff. And with writing, with the arts in general, I mean, it's one of those few industries where being the best doesn't actually really matter. You can be a great writer and your book might just go out at the wrong time, or it might, not resonate with audiences, or, just whatever. It just doesn't click at that time. And that's just generally writing. There's plenty of authors who become famous long after their deaths. So you're at the whims of so many different things, of timing, audiences, tastes, and all that sort of stuff. All you can do is put the best product out and then try and push it as much as possible. There's really no formula for a bestseller. And if there was, like all the big publishers with big marketing dollars behind them would be producing bestseller after bestseller after bestseller. They don't do that. They have a handful of bestsellers, then they have a handful of moderate sellers, and then they have, a lot of underperformers. And that's just the reality of the arts in general. I mean, it happens in music also. And then meanwhile, the same quality doesn't always matter. I won't name any books, but there's been some really average books that have become huge globally.
Do you think that's to do with the, so there's some people who, that's their profession. They sort of work and tweak and do what they do for the algorithms to get the book up there, especially on like Amazon charts and all that sort of stuff to hit the bestseller status. Do you think, people pay for that?
Amazon used to sort of have little loopholes that you could use to push your book up. I mean, they don't do it anymore, but one I recall years ago was you could put it up for like an ebook for free and everybody would download it, and that's going to push it up the charts. And then once it's actually in, it's not selling, but it's in the best-selling charts, and they start charging for it. And it was a loophole, and they closed that out. And they are constantly doing that. They're looking at ways of closing out people who game the system. I mean, the marketing aspect is so important, but it's also, I remember 15 years ago when I was studying, I went back to school as a mid-year student. That's 17 years ago now. And they were saying, you should have a website, you should blog, you should get social media. And it's like, okay, people are still being told that today, and it's really useful to do, but everyone's doing it. So you've got to think about ways you can break out. And I always tell authors, don't think about what's happening today. Think about what's going to happen tomorrow, because you need to get ahead of the curve. And then there's just lateral ways. We saw Matthew Riley speak many, many years ago, because he self-published his first book.
Yeah, he did.
And he said he would sit on buses pretending he was reading his own book and holding it up so the cover was splayed open so everyone could see. And he'd make appreciative noises so people would think, oh, that he must be really be enjoying that.
Must have had a lot of time on his hands, eh?
But
Riding up
it's
and down
yeah.
the street.
So I mean, it's just stuff like that. Just I mean, so you got to think about ways, and then there are traditional ways. You're trying to get reviews, you're trying to get interviews and that sort of stuff. Don't leave that stuff late. A lot of people think, oh, I'm going to release my book now, I'm going to try and get those things. I mean, a lot of these people, a lot of reviewers are booked out for months and months in advance. So you're going to be doing this, you're going to be thinking like 6 months down the track, because reviewers want to review books when they come out. They don't want to review them 6 months after they're out. And it's like movies. Movies are reviewed when they come out, not 6 months later. So, you really want to put all that advanced hype into it. And similarly, like with movies, with movies, you don't just learn of a movie when it comes out. 6 months before it comes out, they'll release a 30-second teaser. Then they might do another one a month later. And then they'll do like a 2 minute trailer. And then a month later, they'll do another 2 minute trailer. And then, a month before it comes out, they might send the actors out to do some press. So in that 6 month lead up or so, they're constantly hyping up the movie. So when it actually does come out, there's all this buzz and expectation for it. And that's where it's meant to pay off. And books are the same. The difference with books is, I mean, the beauty of books is books are immortal. They're going to be out there forever. So, and particularly with like print on demand technology, I mean, previously, if you were doing pre-established print runs, once that book's, because if you look at a bookstore, there's constantly new books coming in.
It's hard not to feel overwhelmed as well with the amount of books that are out there. And also, I keep hearing as well that some people, they've put a work out there, and then 5 years later, all this stuff happens with it. It just either takes off or it's whatever. So yeah, it's crazy.
But that's what I was going to say. Like, if you did an established print run of 500 books and went and got it in bookstores, I mean, they're going to keep it in stock for a little while, and they're working on consignment, so they're not paying you until they're selling books. And then once it's had its run, if it's not doing well, they're going to return it to you or return it to the publisher. And it's not uncommon for books to be pulped. So the really good thing about print on demand and being your own micro publisher is you digitally catalog these things, so they're out there on Amazon and all these places, and they're out there forever. There's no reason, the print on demand facilities don't have expiration dates, so the book can just sit there in perpetuity. So short of a nuclear war and electromagnetic pulses wiping out hard drives and all that sort of stuff, the book's always going to be there. And the one thing I always sort of say, I ask authors that I work with here, or I try assess, is like, is this author just like I call them one-shot authors, some of them, and they're the people who are just doing like a bio or memoir or family history, and that's all they want to do. But then you get like career authors, people who are like, I want to make a career out of this. I want to release, book after book after book. And that's where I sort of say, well, if you're going to do that, you should think about really branding as your own micro publisher and come up with a name. It can be, whatever you like it to be. Go register the business name if you really want to take it that far. Get a logo design. You can register for your own ISBNs. I mean, they have a joining fee, but you can register them under your own publishing name. And both platforms of Kindle Direct Publishing and Ingram Spark, they allow you to put your publisher name in there. So, When you're uploading your book, you can, let's say you call it Morell Publishing. When that appears on all these digital all these retailers, it'll appear under Morell Publishing. So it doesn't also look totally self-published, because I know people still have a bit of a trepidation about the stigma that's attached to self-publishing. So you can really set yourself up to be your own publisher, and the greater audience won't really, they won't know any better whether it's self-published or traditionally published. And then you just keep releasing books. And one of the things about writing, and again, it's probably about a lot of the arts, it's about perseverance. So we all want that dream story that we release a book and it's an overnight success and yay, we all celebrate and all that. But the amount of people who have the overnight success is really, really, really slim. Most people are just there slogging it out. And it's not until they sort of have three, four, five books out there that they really start to develop a readership. Because what happens is someone reads their book and says, well, I like this. What else has this author done? And then they look them up and they find, oh, hang on, they've got three, four books out there. And so you you create this viral awareness for yourself as an author. And you're not just an author, you're also a brand for your work. So you're creating this awareness for yourself and your writing. So it's you get this prevalence that happens both on the internet, but you also get from word of mouth. The people then start talking about you. Whereas if you just have that one book out there, someone might like it and then go, oh, what else have they written? And then they turn around and go, well, they've got nothing else out. And that's it. You're flavor of the month for that month and you're forgotten. And then if you release another book 2, 3 years later, like people have probably forgotten about you. So as a writer and as a career writer and someone, like if you are setting up your own micro publisher, I mean, you have to look at like the permanence of how you infiltrate, for the want of a better word, that space in readers' consciousness and how you actually create that awareness for yourself and your writing.
Yeah, no, that's really, really good advice there. And especially, as I said just before, feeling overwhelmed a little bit of how many books are out there and how many people it feels like are self-publishing. And like you said, it's seen as a really good aspect now, a really good option. So there is a
Well,
lot more
yeah.
people turning to
I mean, the one
it.
thing I've learned through my journey, sorry to interrupt you,
No, you go.
is, I mean, I've been writing, geez, it's a long time, it's about 37 years. And, I used to go through all that disappointment and this despondency when I'd get a rejection from a traditional publisher and all that, and I'd question myself, am I good enough and all that sort of stuff. And I really developed an attitude, probably, and it's only really recent, so probably only about the last 5, 6 years. It's like all you can do is the best for your work. So, do get a professional editor, get some, or no, even before that, have some workshopping buddies that you can swap stories with, people you trust to give you constructive and honest feedback. Really work on putting the best product out there. And once you've done that, it's really up to, the winds or the gods or whatever you want to call it. And there's no point sort of investing in it because you have no control over it. So it's really just being able to tell yourself, look, I've done the very best I can. Whatever happens next, and I'll just accept it. If you start investing expectation in it, that's where you get disappointed because you might not get the sales you want, and most people don't. So, I mean, that's the other reality. You got to keep it in context. If you're not getting the sales you want, you're not the only one. This is happening to authors everywhere, and that's just the reality of the industry too. So,
Would your advice be to keep writing the next book and just keep
yeah,
going
keep
on?
writing. So yeah, examine why you're doing this too. I've had conversations with authors and I've asked them, why do you write? And if you really sort of push them and get to it, it's because they love to tell stories. Sure, again, we'd all love the riches and the fame and the adulation and all that sort of stuff, but that's a byproduct. So really, if you're writing, you should be writing because you have that desire to tell stories, to share stories with people. And that's what I sort of eventually found out about myself in terms of, because I went through all the traditional publishing route, I didn't have the sales I expected for you, and that's no fault of anyone. That's just the reality of the industry again. And I was really disappointed and all that sort of stuff, and went through, oh, what am I doing and all that. But then just sort of realized, look, my books aren't perfect, but I think they're pretty good. So I've done the best I can. So just take pride in that. I have no control over what reviewers think and what sales think and all that sort of stuff. So if you start to worry about that, you'll really obsess about the negative. And I know from experience, and I've spoken to writer friends, you could go to Goodreads and have 100 reviews, and 99 of them can be brilliant. And you will focus on that one bad one.
Yeah, it does happen, doesn't
Yeah.
it?
So, it's don't invest in that because you're really just tormenting yourself. Just take pride in what you've done and take pride in trying to do the very best that you can do. And this is the other thing with writers that I found and I've learned. Like, so everything I talk about, like I've gone through myself. So I'm not sort of mocking inexperienced writers because I've done this myself. But like I actually found also, I had a friend who went to a workshop and he's very, very experienced writer and very well respected in the industry. And he said he turned over his short story and he was just petrified what people were going to say. And he said some 20-year-old guy walked in, handed his short story, just really cocky. He goes, I don't get it. He goes, why is that guy so cocky? And I'm petrified. I've 20 years on him. And I really thought about that for a while. And then I sort of realized, because the 20-year-old doesn't know what might be wrong with his story. He just believes it's brilliant. Whereas my friend, who's like I said, very respected and in the industry, he knows all the things that could possibly be wrong, and he's also isn't arrogant enough to believe there might be things wrong he hasn't even contemplated. So the more experience you get, the more self-doubt you get. But in a way, it's good because it drives you to improve, and it drives you to evolve, and it drives you to find ways to say things better, to write things better, to constantly get better. One of the biggest threats to any artistic endeavor is just complacency, that thinking you're there, you're great, because if you're not being challenged, then you are going to start producing not your best work. You're going to just start producing things that are, I think you sort of see this with some filmmakers who've reached a level where they're revered, but then their work sort of really drops off. And same with authors too. And I feel it's because I no longer have those people around them challenging them, saying, is this the best, idea, or is this character motivated, or have you considered this plot hole or whatever? And that's a good thing because you go away and you think, okay, how do I improve that? And how do I answer? Because the other thing with writing too is you send your work out there and your work has to stand for itself. You're not there explaining to a reader why this has happened or what you meant by this. So the work has to answer every question the reader has before the reader ever realizes they're going to ask that question. So sort of gone off on a tangent, but
No,
just
I'm loving it. It's great. Honestly, it's good.
so yeah, just to say, like, don't ever, take shortcuts and really take pride in what you're doing and do it for the love of doing it rather than doing it for, because you want to be rich and all that sort of stuff. If that happens, great, but
Yeah, that would be
that shouldn't be your
good
priority.
too. No, not at all. I know they say that.
I mean, I
And
think
don't get complacent.
I can't remember if it was Samuel L. Jackson, but I'm pretty sure it was Samuel L. Jackson, but there's some actor I remember who said it took me 20 years to become an overnight sensation. And he was just talking, I'm pretty sure it was Samuel L. Jackson, but he was sort of saying like he was around in movies for ages and no one really took notice of him. And then he had like the hit and everyone's like, oh, hey, Samuel L. Jackson, what a great actor. And it's an interesting one because if you watch old movies, you'll see him pop up in so many different things in small parts, like from Jurassic Park to The Sea of Love with Al Pacino. He's just got these tiny little parts. He was always there. And it's a good lesson too because it's just perseverance. You just get pushing and pushing and then he finally got his recognition. And that's
It's I think it's maybe people outside of the industry as well, though, like that do think you're an overnight sensation because they don't, like you said, especially for writing, they don't see you chipping away at it. And if you've got nothing before, or you could have about, like myself, five unpublished manuscripts sitting at home, but each one's been a lesson learned, and 10 years and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, same as I think, because Adam Sandler, he pops up for like 5 or 10 minutes in, I don't know if you've seen it, but it used to be one of my favorite movies with Dan Aykroyd and I can't mind who else is in it. The Coneheads. Do you
yeah,
remember that?
I don't remember it, but I remember the movie
He,
Jane Curtin
well,
here.
yeah, Adam Sandler, just he's got a minor part in it to just give the Coneheads their fake like green card or whatever, and it only twigged. I watched that as a kid so many times, and then when I watched it, I was older because he's really famous. I was like, oh my gosh, there's him. And there was an older 90s movie as well. It was like a love movie with Freddie Prinze Jr. and Lumen, oh sorry, Julia Stiles. And Ashton Kutcher is in it, and he has got no speaking part. He's in it for like 2 seconds in the background, and he's massive now. Do you know? It's
Yeah,
yeah, it's funny.
I've been watching John Hughes movies lately, and they're just like there's a lot of people like John Cusack and all these other actors are sort of appearing in, I can't remember, 16 Candles or Pretty in Pink. There's all these actors who went on to really big careers who just sort of had these bit parts in some of these films. But again, it's just a push. It's just you got to keep trying. And it can be really dispiriting when you get rejections or when you don't get sales or you might get bad reviews or whatever. But it really is a case of perseverance, because nothing's going to happen if you give up.
That's it.
And that's all it comes. And if you, if, unfortunately, you've chosen, like the writers listening, a really difficult industry.
Yeah, but
If
in the same breath as well, like although people might not reap initially in the beginning the financial rewards that they want, like I've got to say, I have to laugh that I've entered this profession because it requires you to be disciplined and all these things, and which were all the things I was not as a younger person. So to come in and do this, it sort of shapes you as a person. Like there's other things as well, I think, that you
Oh
get.
yeah, I definitely. I mean, I'm the same. I have a discipline in writing I probably don't have in a lot of the rest of my life. But again, I mean, the really good thing I think with writers is you have a love of something so passionate that you want to do it regardless of the fact that it is like walking into a tidal wave a lot of the time. And I think that's pretty special, because a lot of people never really discover their passion in life. That they just do whatever they need to do. And as I said before, for me, and I've had mental health issues with anxiety and stuff over my life, writing's the one time I actually feel at peace, where I just feel like I'm in control. And there's times like where I write, I'll be whatever halfway through a novel, and I'll think, oh, I didn't realize that was going to connect up that way. So you also get these sort of aha moments, and you think, oh, maybe I'm a little bit cleverer than I thought it was.
You
And this, oh, I was just going to say, I've been working on a sci-fi novel, which I finished Christmas last year, and I've just, with work and stuff, I've been really slow in revising. And it was a real messy novel. But going through it now and giving it some shape, like I said, it's really gratifying. So, when you see that vision sort of taking form, it gives you this really good buzz.
It's
So.
crazy how it does all just come together. Like you can be feeling like you're sort of, oh gosh, I'm never gonna this and this and that. And then at the end, it just trust the process because it does all just come together magically.
Oh,
Not well,
it's yeah.
spiritually, I suppose, as well.
It's funny too, because I've had experiences where I might have sent out two short stories or even two screenplays or something, and there's one I think, oh yeah, this is a really good chance of whatever getting accepted or what, and then there's the other one which is like, that's an afterthought, and it's the afterthought that
Gets
gets selected. Yeah, so
it,
you're also like a generally you're the worst judge of your own work too, because you are your own worst critic. I mean, that's the other thing with writers, which I find really funny, is. It's people in general, but you speak to yourself in a way you'd never speak to friends. Like if you had a friend who was written something and got a rejection, you'd really encourage them and support them. But the way you talk to yourself is, you get really down on yourself and,
yeah.
am I any good? Why am I doing this? Why don't I just give up? So we can be really harsh on ourselves. And I mean, I think a lot of writers do have a really deep level of empathy, which I think develops from having to imagine the way characters think in different situations and all that sort of stuff. Writers, I find, tend to feel very, very, very deeply. But the flip side of that is when things are going wrong, they tend to feel that very, very, very deeply. So the other lesson would be kind to yourself, because it is a difficult industry.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, well said there for everything, Les. And I could absolutely talk to you all day, but we'll have to wrap up. But our listeners would love to know where they can discover you, your books, everything you do, your work with authors on and offline.
Okay, so I work for Busy Bird Publishing, which is www.busybird.com.au, and you can find my website www.leszieg.com. There's no AU on that. And my books would still be on places like Amazon and Booktopia and those sort of places. My latest on my YA novel came out last year with that one was traditionally published, Midnight Sun Publishing. That was called This, and that was just a bit, that was very biographical. It was a lot about my mental health experiences as a teen, but I've just sort of smashed into 1 year. And then I'm hoping this year to bring out one myself as a Les Zig book. So, and that's the other thing I always say of writing, always be writing. I just find it so, regardless of how you feel, try and write a little bit, because you just want to discipline yourself and teach yourself that, look, I'm doing this regardless of the reasons, or sorry, not the reasons, the excuses I shouldn't. Because when we do get down on ourselves, we want to quit, and people sometimes go, I want to watch this TV show, or I can't be bothered. Actually, the one last thing I'll say with writing too is a lot of people, a lot of inexperienced people, have this romanticized notion about what a brilliant trip it is. It's all ecstasy. It's all Hemingway in France and all that sort of stuff. And writing is really difficult at times, and it is really frustrating and painful. And I always say it's very much like a relationship in a lot of ways, that you don't always love your partner. Sometimes they just drive you nuts, sometimes they make you angry, sometimes you feel like you don't love them, sometimes they bore you and all that sort of stuff. But if the core of it's true, you always return to it. So if you're writing and just finding it a really difficult slog, don't stress, that it can be, but you'll just push through it.
Absolutely. For me, I get a lot of ideas and stuff like that, and then I think to the end of my life, whenever that may be, that would be a regret of mine if I didn't give life to the ideas and the stories that I've got. That's w regardless of whether it makes money or it gets made or whatever happens. It's yeah, for me, I'm much like yourself. I've got to do this. It feels like a calling. So.
Yeah, well, my boss Blaise Van Heck, so she passed away a couple of years ago unexpectedly, and but she used to really encourage people to write and just leave their stories behind as a legacy. And that's one truth. I mean, you look at people like Shakespeare, and that their stories are still here long after they're gone.
Oh, yeah.
So we can leave something behind for not just our family and friends, but for future generations.
Yeah, and like you said, it's if it's not the time now, like who knows when it is the time that is going to be important
Well,
posthumous.
yeah. Well, I mean, go back to my friend Blaze. Like I said, she passed away unexpectedly, so we don't know what's going to happen from any given moment. So take advantage of the moment while you still have it, because
That's
we
it.
don't know what's coming.
That's it. Yes. Well, thank you so much, Les. It's been so insightful and inspiring talking to you. Thanks again for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me on, Joe.
So there you have it, folks. The absolutely amazing Les Zigg. What a knowledgeable fellow. So much experience in the industry. I hope you'll check out Les's books, everything he does, over at his website. Next time on the Hybrid Author Podcast, we have an almost mid-year mashup of some of the guests from the start of 2024. Can you believe we are almost in? We're almost halfway through the year. It's an absolute spin out. I wish you well on your author adventure this next week. That's it from me. Bye for now.
That's the end for now, authors. I hope you are further forward in your author adventure after listening, and I hope you'll listen next time. Remember to head on over to the Hybrid Author website at www.hybridauthor.com.au to get your free author pass. It's bye for now.